The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good evening. And as I said earlier, the topic for today's talk is going to be ease. And I love the word ease. And it's such a, to me, inspiring word. And it's a very rich word. And in thinking about coming down to talk about it today, I looked it up in the dictionary, what ease meant. And I was surprised by all the different definitions in my dictionary, Webster Dictionary. So if you allow me, I'll read dictionary definitions. Ease. As a noun, it means freedom from pain, worry, or trouble. And a synonym is comfort. Two, freedom from constraint, formality, or awkwardness. And the synonyms are poise, natural, easy, manner. Three, freedom from difficulty, facility, or readiness. Isn't it interesting how many times the word freedom appears in definition? Four, freedom from poverty, a state of being financially comfortable. Five, rest, relaxation, and leisure. And also is used as a verb. And the verb, it has five definitions. One, to free from pain, worry, or trouble. To lessen or alleviate, like lessen pain or anxiety. To make easier, to facilitate something. To reduce the strain, tension, pressure, like slacken the tension in the rope. To fit something carefully, or to move something carefully. That is nice. And then it has all these wonderful related words like easy, be easy, or ease up. So the picture I put here up on the altar is a photograph of a statue, a Chinese Buddhist statue that's housed in the museum in Kansas City. And it's a statue. This picture was given to IMC by Andrea Fella when we first moved into this building. She had it for many years and she was waiting for the right opportunity to give it to some, you know, pass it on. And when we bought this building, she gave it to us. It's the Bodhisattva, the great kind of archetypical representation of compassion. So Kuan Yin in Chinese, or Avalokiteshvara in Sanskrit. And so she's the one who sees the cries of the world. It's the embodiment of compassion. So here she is sitting up on this, looks like the edge of a cliff of a mountain, looking down. And her eyes are clearly focused down on the world below, our world, on us, and gazes with compassion. That's what she looks on the world with compassion. But the pose she's sitting in is called the pose of ease. So she has one leg sitting on the edge of the cliff, kind of ledge, and one foot over the ledge, and the other one up, tucked in close to her hips, with the knee up, so she can put her arm over the top of the knee. Resting there, kind of draping the arm kind of gently across the top of the knee, kind of at ease. So it's very interesting, this juxtaposition of compassion and ease. How often do you associate compassion with ease, being relaxed, being at leisure, freedom from pain, worry, or trouble, freedom from constraint, formality, or awkwardness, freedom from difficulty. And certainly it's the function of compassionate beings to ease the suffering of the world and to alleviate it, to free people of their anxiety. And so, but it's one thing to ease others. It's another thing to be at ease with yourself. And many people, when they encounter the suffering of the world, feel a tremendous amount of anxiety. And it doesn't take much to read the paper or find the news and find out what's going around, or you know, find out some local suffering in your neighborhood or with yourself or whatever. And many people get quite upset. They get certainly anxious. Despairing is one possibility. Worrying. Some people feel that how can they possibly show the world their great care and concern and compassion unless they worry? Worrying is the proof that we care, right? So we should run around, you know, like chickens without a head, you know, worrying to prove our care. But here, this statue here depicts someone who's meant to be the embodiment of compassion, being quite at ease, restful, relaxed. I believe that it's our compassion flows much more cleanly when we're at ease, when we're relaxed. And I think that when compassion is clean, there's a kind of ease to it. But when we resist it, when we cling to something, then that's when the suffering of the world elicits something different than ease. Easeful compassion, compassionate ease, but elicits worry or anxiety or despair or something. So one of the great challenges, I think, of spiritual life is not just to awaken compassion, but to awaken the kind of compassion that allows us to gaze on the world with ease. We can encounter some suffering of the world and somehow stay relaxed with it. It doesn't mean that our hearts are not broken. I suspect that Lakdeshvara's heart is broken 10,000 times every day, sitting there looking at the suffering of the world. But probably is at ease, relaxed with that. As I like to say, if you're only free when you're comfortable, you're not really free. And so part of the task of, I think, mature spirituality is to learn a kind of freedom that allows us to enter into situations which are quite uncomfortable, where we're uncomfortable, but to have a kind of odd comfort with discomfort, or freedom from discomfort. Not to measure spiritual attainment or maturity by living in a cloud of joy and light and being able to whistle Dixie wherever you go. but rather, I think it's to have a very direct contact with the world and be impacted by it. But can we allow that impact to happen without getting distressed? Can we let the impact happen without clinging and grasping to something? So the word ease, so not only is associated with compassion, but it's also associated with freedom. Many of the dictionary definitions have freedom at the beginning of the definition. And freedom is a key quality of spiritual maturity in Buddhism. That psychologically, mentally, emotionally, heartfully, the person becomes more free. And as we become more free in body, mind, and heart, there's more sense of ease, that refreshing sense of coolness, of ease, or lightness, or, I associate ease with a feeling of refreshment, being refreshed. We have two words in English for the opposite of ease. We have unease, be uneasy, and we have dis-ease. Do we have any more like that? Unease and dis-ease. And sometimes people have tried to translate the Buddhist word for dukkha. Dukkha is usually translated as suffering. They usually do this the hyphenated, so it doesn't mean the regular disease of illness. evoke the kind of power of the word disease in English. And so they'll translate dukkha as dis-ease, dis-ease, to be uneasy in some way. And to be uneasy, I think, has to do with how we are relating to the world, our relationship to the world, something we're doing. The world does not make us uneasy. We have an uneasy relationship with the world. The world can cause our hearts to break, but it doesn't have to cause us to lose our ease. So to feel uneasy is something that we have to take responsibility for. It's something that something about the response that comes from us in relationship to what's happening in the world. And Buddhist spirituality, the hallmark of Buddhist spirituality, is to really take responsibility for that part of the equation that you're producing, that you're causing, that you have some say over. And so if we're focusing on dis-ease or uneasiness, what is your role with being uneasy? And I would like to suggest tonight that one of the most effective places to look at how we become uneasy is to look and see what our relationship is to thinking. And I suspect a huge percentage of people's unease comes from latching on to our thoughts, grabbing on to cling them, believing them. So, for example, the future, your future at this point, any thought you have about your future is really imaginary for the most part. I mean, you know, your future. You know, most of you know that in 100 years you're not going to be around. That's in your future. That's not so imaginary. But there, you know, to have concrete and what's going to happen tomorrow or the next day is imaginary. I feel like I've been a very slow learner, but I've learned from, because of the 84,000 times which I anticipated the future, only to have the future be different than my anticipation. It finally dawned on me that what a poor track record I had for predicting the future. And when that dawned on me, then finally I was able to ease up. Isn't that great? Ease up, isn't that great? Ease up with the way in which I latched on to my imagination about what the future was going to bring, what was going to happen. And as I eased up, I stayed more relaxed. I stayed more at ease. Who knows what's going to happen? You can plan. That's fine to plan some, but who knows? And generally, what I found in my particular disposition was I usually anticipated terrible futures. Terrible things were going to happen in my future, tomorrow, the next day. And those are generally, it was the terrible futures that didn't happen. I mean, sometimes I had good futures, but and they didn't happen. But more often than not, I had terrible futures. And if those terrible futures didn't happen. So, but not getting so wrapped up about these thoughts about good or bad futures, and not being caught by the anticipation, leaves me much more at ease. Who knows what's going to happen tomorrow? I'll wake up tomorrow and we'll see. The world could be different, upside down. I've had major plans, you know, probably all of you have had, where one day to the next, you know, they change radically. I remember my colleague, a friend, John Travis, had something happen to him when he was, kind of a tragic thing happened to him when he was like about 18. And as soon as it happened, his first thoughts was, my life now has changed forever. Just like that. So the point I'm trying to make here is that our thinking, our way we latch on and relate to thinking, is one of the keys to look at to understand how we bring ourselves uneasiness. And if we want to learn how to be more easy, we need to learn how to relate to thoughts in an easier way. Not to be bothered by them, not to latch on to them, not to be pushed around by them, not to believe all the thoughts you have. I think one of the great results of mindfulness practice, hopefully, is we learn that we don't have to believe what we think. That's a real challenge for some people who are so closely identified with their thinking that they think they are their thoughts. It's inconceivable to, you know, that not to think, because if they don't think, then they can't tell themselves a story about who they are or who they are in relationship to other people. And some people actually find it quite frightening to kind of let up, ease up on the grip they have on their thoughts, or the grip the thoughts have on them. So to let up, lighten up, relax around thinking. And it was very important for me, the instructions that I got from Zen. And the Zen instructions around thinking were, don't be bothered by your thoughts. And many meditators are bothered by their thinking. Were some of you bothered today, sitting here meditating? If you were bothered, then perhaps you can experiment with how to leave your thoughts alone. Leave them alone. Now, if you weren't bothered by your thoughts tonight, maybe that's great. Or maybe you're complacent. Maybe you just kind of went along with them, you know, freely. I just think, you know, don't be bothered with your thoughts. I'll just think freely. So how is it not to be latched onto your thoughts, but also not to be repulsed by them or, you know, caught in their orbit? Some things are just best left alone. And I found that for the most part, the best strategy I've had for my thinking is to leave them alone and not focus on them, but not necessarily focus on stopping them or anything. Just focus on my breath, focus on my practice, and then slowly they relax by themselves and they thin out. But in that thinning process, that relaxing process around thinking, that leaving them alone, I found to be a very powerful lesson, learning, for not latching onto them. It's kind of a training of the mind not to always go to thoughts and hang on to them. So then there are particular thoughts which can be particularly have strong hooks that pull us in. And one of the strong hooks that can create a lot of uneasiness is all our thoughts around desires, all the things that we want. And there can be uneasiness because we're driven to get it, and there can be uneasiness because we don't get it. And people can spin out quite a bit around the whole realm of wanting. It can happen in meditation. Some people want so much to have certain experiences in meditation that they feel very uneasy because not having it. My neighbor, certainly, is in samadhi. But me, poor me, you know, I can't even, you know, I'm embarrassed to even open my eyes, because then people will see that how agitated I am. And so then we're agitated because we're agitated. And a really powerful way of meditating is to be at ease with how things are. And if you're uneasy, to be at ease with that. And so that was what in the guided meditation I did earlier today, was an attempt to kind of pass on that kind of instruction, that if you're uneasy in some way about something, uneasy in your body, uneasy in your heart, in your feelings, uneasy in your mind, can you ease up with that? Can you be easy with that? Be at ease in that area. Be at ease with what is. And desires, having desire for certain things to be a certain way, is one of the ways of feeling uneasy. So in order to develop greater ease, we have to be able to develop a different relationship to our desires. To not believe every desire. And then another very powerful source of uneasiness has to do with all the thoughts we have about who we think we are, about our self-identity, the way we want to represent ourselves to the world around us. I've seen my mind function in overdrive when I was really eagerly wanting to make an impression on someone else. I wanted them to see me a certain way. I wanted them to like me. I wanted them to think I was great. I wanted them to think I was smart. I wanted them to think that I was whatever. They say, it's been a saying that some people give more care to what clothes they wear than the words they speak. And why do we give more care to our clothes? Sometimes because of the impression we're trying to make to other people. So some way or other, we have ideas about self. We want to defend ourselves. We want to build up ourselves. We want to create an image of ourselves. We want to prove ourselves. We want to be better than others. All kinds of things we want to do about the self. We want to be worthwhile. We want to feel like we're successful. We want to look good in the eyes of other people. Some people want to look, in the Buddhist world, some people want to look good in the eyes of their teachers. And then they try to kind of be good Buddhists. And really, the world should be saved from people trying to be good Buddhists. I mean, it's nice to have good Buddhists. I don't want to be critical of good Buddhists. I mean, probably the world needs more good Buddhists. People who are kinder, more compassionate, more mindful, and so forth. And aspiring to those things is a great thing. But trying to kind of pretend that you're, better than you are, pretending that you're kind of spiritually Buddhist, pretending that you're, kind and sweet, is when you're really grumpy inside. It's not a very good thing for the world. So to ease up on self-preoccupation, to ease up on needing to be anything for anybody, is one of the ways of having more ease. It's also one of the ways to have more compassion. Because if we're caught up in self-image, me, myself, and mine, it's a barrier through which it's very hard for the sensitivity of the heart, that sense of inner sensitivity that feels empathy and compassion, it's very hard for that sense of sensitivity to travel through that veil of me, myself, and mine when we're latching on to thoughts of me, myself, and mine. So who are you when you don't have any thoughts to tell you? If you're not allowed to use thinking to tell you who you are, who are you? I don't think you can then use words, thoughts, or mental images to depict who you are. What you're left with is you have to feel who you are. There's other organs of perceptions besides thinking, which to perceive. But if you perceive without thoughts of self, what is it you perceive? What's left when you're not telling yourself a story? What's more immediate than a story or a thought or an idea when you really turn and really experience yourself? If you experience yourself without a thought, you wouldn't compare yourself to anybody else. Because comparison, better than, worse than, equal to others, belongs to the realm of thinking. Is it okay not to be not to be alive and be present and vital and vibrant without comparisons, without making a comparison to yourself or somebody else? When you sit and meditate, sooner or later you have to learn that lesson, that it's really worthwhile, worthy, beneficial to be vitally, vibrantly alive, be present here, independent of any comparisons you can make about who you are. Comparisons to other people, comparisons to who you were in the past, comparisons to who you think you might be in the future, comparisons to ideals you have. Just to be here. It's quite something. To let go of the thoughts of comparative thinking. To let go of the thoughts about what's going to happen to you tomorrow, the next day, the next week. To let go of the thoughts of success and failure. To let go of the thoughts of who you were in the past. All the good things, terrible things you've done. What is it just to be here? And I'll say again, that ability to drop all those world of thinking and self is a powerful doorway for compassion. Because compassion needs that clarity of presence in order to really pick up, register what's going on around us. So to be at ease. What if being at ease was the key reference point for what guides you in your life? What if being at ease was the key value or the key sense of meaning for what is most important for you? I think maybe it might be a little bit hard to take that on as being so centrally important, because it seems like a very modest goal to be at ease. Aren't there more important things than being at ease? There might be. There might be more important things than being at ease. But there's no reason to sacrifice your ease for those things. You follow that? There's no reason to sacrifice your ease for things that might be more important than your ease. So some people say compassionate love is more important than ease. But there's no need to sacrifice your ease for your compassionate love. And perhaps if you guide your life by what brings you greater ease, perhaps you'll find that some of the most other things that are most valuable for you will shine through more beautifully. The spiritual things, the deeper things that's really important. So one of the practices I like to teach is has to do with ease. And that is to establish yourself in some modicum of ease. So maybe you can't do a good job at it yet. But you can do some, you know, because, you know, there's still probably a range through the day or through the year or something between situations where you're a little more relaxed and a little more anxious. You know, kind of sit, go for a walk, sit and meditate, do something to get a little bit calmer than usual. Get a little more sense of ease. And then be very diligent to notice the thing that takes you away from that, that causes you to lose that. That one practice, establish some ease and look what takes you away from it. Stop. You know, if you start feeling you're losing that ease or that calm or that relaxed state, stop and look at that. If you do that regularly, you'll learn everything you need to learn about your spirit, you know, you need on the spiritual path. It'll all come through, it'll all come out in the wash if you use that as a reference point. And you get this added benefit that's quite immediate. You immediately get to kind of negotiate the world of ease. If you use other reference points for your spiritual life, it might not be, the immediate benefits might not be so obvious. There's a lot of Buddhist practitioners who put all their eggs in the basket of getting concentrated. Right? And so they try so hard to get concentrated. And some of the times they're successful and sometimes they're not. But the effort sometimes people burn out. I've known people who've burned out trying to get concentrated because there's not an adequate ease in that. They have those ideas of what concentrated state looks like. So they're looking for something that takes them away from their ease. And they don't notice that it's taking them away from their ease because they're focusing on something else. But what if ease was the reference point? Then if you notice yourself leaving your ease, then perhaps it's easier to come back to it. come back to it. Some people will have to wrestle with this, wrestle with themselves in that process. It's not an easy thing to do, because as we feel ourselves leaving our ease, feeling uneasy, there can be very powerful beliefs that come into play about why it's not okay to be relaxed, why it's important to be anxious. And so we get to wrestle with that, grapple with it, try to understand more deeply what's really going on here, before we can come back to reestablish ourselves in a state of ease. So the last thing I'll say about ease is that in Buddhism, one of the ways that ease is experienced is very physical. It's kind of a deep sense in the body and in the muscles and the bones, kind of refreshing, sublime, cool feeling that kind of spreads throughout the body, throughout the being. And that translates itself into ease of activity, into ease of mind, ease of heart. But more important, as we have some sense of ease and trust the place of ease, then it might be easier to trust the innate intelligence that you have. The innate operation of wisdom, the innate bubbling up of the right response in different situations. You don't have to plan ahead all the time to think of the perfect rejoinder. But rather, you don't have to kind of be tying yourself in a pretzel to try to figure out what to do in different situations. But that what bubbles up through that ease, the response to the world that bubbles up through that ease, might be just the right response. And to trust that natural, innate arising of intelligence is one of the beautiful qualities that comes out of that ease. Because then you trust yourself. So, those are my thoughts about ease. Would you like to ask any questions? Would you like to make any comments? Ursula?
So let's say you are at ease and you feel suddenly a thought come up about something you haven't finished or something, and you feel this tension arising. So what concretely do you do?
Well, it all depends on the thing, but it arises. But the first thing that occurred to me hearing your description was maybe it really represents something that needs to be addressed, something that's unresolved. Mm-hmm. And so perhaps in order to kind of allow yourself to go back to some sense of ease is to set your mind, resolve your mind, that you're going to take care of this. Maybe after meditation I'm going to think about it and figure out what to do, or after meditation I'm going to go call this person up and deal with it, or something. And then, knowing that it's going to be taken care of the best you can, then you set yourself down. Or if it's not obvious how to resolve the issue, at least knowing that you're taking it seriously and you're going to address it at some point or do your best with it can help something feel more at ease with it.
And then another question, sorry guys. Sometimes unease just arises without my knowing what actually is happening. Just somehow I feel suddenly uneasy or nervous.
Yeah, I've noticed that. That happens to me too sometimes. I seem to notice that if I eat too much chocolate, I get this kind of uneasy feeling later. So I don't think in my case
it's the chocolate.
You know, not the chocolate. So I kind of learned not to eat too much chocolate. I just like one or two little pieces is nice, but I kind of odd the way I feel afterwards. So. But anyway, I don't know. You know what? There might be biological reasons for why we feel uneasy sometimes. But
just then watch the body, or what do you do?
But that's where I think having some ability. You know, if the uneasiness feels like something you want to address, you know, if it's physical uneasiness, That's different than mental uneasiness. And some people assume whenever they're physically uneasy, that means that they're also mentally uneasy because we identify so strongly with the body. And I've learned to be uneasy in my body, but at ease in my mind. So like that nameless chocolate thing, right? I mean, my mind doesn't care. My mind doesn't care, right? It's just my body feels a certain kind of jittery kind of way or something, and my mind seems pretty, you know, okay. And then having some way of relaxing. So meditating, breathing, exercising. There's various ways you can do to kind of settle yourself.
Thank you.
I saw a hand back there.
I guess I'm getting a little confused on what would be the difference between ease and complacency?
It's a great question. Complacency means that you've given up. You're kind of coasting along without really making any effort. Content with how things are, but in a lazy kind of way. Everything is fine, and so I don't have to do anything here anymore. Does that make sense? That's the best I can come up with as an answer. Maybe in Buddhism we have this idea of the near enemy. A near enemy is when there's a good quality, good mental state, and the near enemy is a mental state which is the opposite but looks similar, so we confuse the two. So maybe complacency and difference can be the near enemies of ease. So.
Hi, Gil.
Hi.
What about the expression ill at ease? Is that primarily physical? The physical manifestation of being?
I never thought about it. I mean, I don't know what people commonly refer to by that term, but I know I would just be content to be a general kind of a synonym of being uneasy. Ill at ease in the mind, ill at ease at heart, ill at ease in the body. You know, just whatever way being uneasy appears, is being ill at ease. But I wonder, ill at ease.
Well, it's just so much more traumatic.
More traumatic, it's stronger?
Yeah. I mean,
I guess I associate being ill at ease as being maybe I have a slight more positive relationship idea of ill at ease. Ill at ease has some idea, some intuitive that something is wrong here. You know, unease can be that way too. You can feel uneasy when you feel like something's wrong here. You know, you're walking down a dark alley late at night, you know, and this big hulking guy with a revolver is walking towards you. And I think feeling kind of ill at ease or uneasy, you know, might be, you know, some kind of signal you need to pay attention to something. So there is a kind of uneasiness which, you know, maybe is something's off here. You know, like I have, you know, my, I was at the beach today with my sons, and it was mostly an easeful time, it was nice. But one of my youngest son, who was 7, crossed the little river that was there and ran far off. And at some point, I felt, as a parent, I felt a little bit uneasy. But it didn't occur to me that I was supposed to get rid of that uneasiness. That uneasiness seemed like part of the deal in being a parent. You know, it's like, you know, okay. So then I had to consider, you know, what am I going to do about this feeling, you know, this, you know, I had to evaluate and decide, is this really, and I realized, I thought about it, looked at the situation, said, no, there's no reason to be uneasy here. And then he came back. Yes.
I'm thinking about dynamics between people.
Yes.
And the sense of ease that happens in relationship. It could be between two people or in a family, like at Thanksgiving or at a town hall on national health care, where there's just something in the space that's that if there's some way to create the conditions for ease or an environment that supports ease, what could be, from what you've seen, something that, whether it's overt or not so overt, that can help to create that sense of ease in relationship?
Well, there's many things. So, you know, there's a whole series of things that can help. But what comes to mind the most is when people feel like they're listened to. I think when people don't feel like they count, when people don't feel like they're listened to or respected, and people feel uneasy. But if the people feel heard, most people relax. Are you satisfied? Okay, great, thank you. Yes?
It feels to me, if I were to have ease, my ease, as my primary purpose, it feels very self-indulgent, first of all. And then secondly, I have a fear, actually based on some experience, that I wouldn't get anything done. So these are the two things. I mean, how can I... It feels so pretentious or so somehow selfish to take my ease as the most important purpose in my life.
The most important purpose. I don't know if I meant it's most important purpose, but it's most important reference point for how to find our way in the world. Because is the world helped by you being anxious?
No, but I feel like I accomplish more when I am anxious.
Ah. So this belongs to a class of concerns that people have that also relates to people's defense of anger. You know, if I'm angry, then I get a lot done. I go out there and fight for justice, and it's important to be angry. And that kind of breaks my heart because, yes, anxiety and anger can be motivating, but so can compassion. And I think compassion can be even more motivating to get ourselves our butts and do something than anxiety and anger. You know, it makes me a little sad to hear that you think that's the case for you. What I suspect is that if you could learn to relax your anxiety completely, deeply, and feel comfortable with being at ease, you probably find a very different force motivating you. You might make different choices, but you'd make than you had to do currently. But you'd find a motivating force inside of you that gets you to act in the world that doesn't require anxiety for that.
Sounds like nirvana.
Well, I don't know if it's nirvana. You don't have to go that far, but I think it's a really worthwhile thing to do, because if this has been your operating mode for your lifetime so far, you've given that a long enough time. I think that it's a reasonable thing. You know, you have a long track record with that approach. I think maybe it's time to try a different one.
Well, it is exhausting, I can tell you that.
Here, Richard, do you want to ask or say something? Did you say here? Oh. Okay. Oh, yes.
Do you have time for one more? Yes. So the difference between complacency and at ease with the way things are. So an example would be in meditation, if a hindrance comes up and you recognize it as a hindrance, and it's really... is just there. There's nothing to be done about it except to recognize it. So sometimes for me, I can accept that as just the way it is. And that's what the whole meditation is. I'm just with the hindrance, recognizing it's a hindrance. I know it's a hindrance, but is that copping out? Is that being complacent? Is there something that should be done about it?
Sometimes you can do things. There's a lot of different approaches to deal with the hindrances at different times.
So this isn't really a question about the hindrance. I want to be clear about that, because the example I'm trying to give is where the hindrance is so strong. Let's say it's sleepiness. Just it comes, and it's just a recognition that it's there, and I have to end the meditation or just, you know, be with it. So sometimes I can find that I can be with it, but afterwards I wonder if I'm just being complacent.
You could be. I think that the difference, complacency is when we kind of lean into something and kind of it has us. So with sleepiness, it has us when we start falling asleep a lot. You're so relaxed, everything's okay, nothing, no problems, I'm at ease with everything, and just kind of nodding off. But if the mindfulness is stronger than the sleepiness, in the sense that the mindfulness steps back and really, in a sense, kind of observes it and sees it and sees and sees it, then it might not be complacency.
So is that an example of being at ease? Because that's a perfect, the way you described it is, mindfulness recognizes it. The sleepiness doesn't overwhelm me.
Right.
I see it. But I'm wondering if that's a way of being at ease, as you were describing it tonight.
Well, sometimes it's better to look at the opposite. You know, are you bothered? Are you upset? Are you anxious? Are you discouraged? Are you, upset by the sleepiness?
So if you notice that you're annoyed in the beginning, but once you recognize what's happening, and still it's just you have to keep applying mindfulness, then it kind of feels like ease. I'm just trying to see if I'm on the right track or not.
Yeah.
Okay,
sounds
thank
good to
you.
Me. Sounds good to me. Well, I thought that was interesting to have those questions. And it seems like it would have been good to have just talked about this as a group the whole time. Because it was kind of interesting to hear the difference. It was interesting about the ill at ease, that idea. And to hear myself think that, hearing that, to think that actually maybe there are times when there's a kind of healthy ill at ease as well that occurs. So to be easy with being uneasy, you know, as well. There's so many things, so many different states and emotions wash through us. It's really, it's really interesting to watch different things. And part of the, I think, freedom is to be fluid in how these different states, emotions move through us, come and go, and not to clamp down any of them or resist anything, but let them come. And sometimes what comes through is some sense of being ill at ease, but don't get uneasy because of that. Don't clamp down or get anxious by that, but to practice with it. And one of the ways of getting greater sense of ease or sense of peace or sense of well-being in our life is to have a lot of confidence in your practice, in your ability and power to be mindful and present for your experience, to be fluid with your experience because you're mindful of it. And so if this theme of ease didn't quite resonate with you tonight, don't worry about it. And please, and just rely on your mindfulness. And with your mindfulness becoming strong, it hopefully will work through whatever unease you have, and you'll discover a natural sense of ease on your own. So, thank you very much.